My name is Michael McCusker. Today I'm going to be interviewed by a woman for a book she's writing. Her name is either Paulina or Paulina Olson. And she wants to talk about Portland in the late 60s and early 70s, in particular the People's Army Jamboree, which happened at about this time in 1970 when the American Legion held its annual convention in Portland and created quite a stir. I'm giving her something that I've written about it, and I have read it on the air at least once or twice, although I've rewritten it a number of times. And I say it's the following is excerpted from a personal recollection of the People's Army Jamboree scribbled to assistant interview by Dory Hilton and subsequently tampered with by revisions and additions. And Dory herself did a very, very interesting piece on the People's Army Jamboree. She's also a jazz singer and has been accompanied by Jessica Williams on piano and also David Horowitz, who just turned 70 yesterday, 2 days before I do. I'll be 70 the first day of Pledge Drive tomorrow. And David and his wife Gloria came and took me out to lunch yesterday. So I asked him, what's it like? He's 2 days ahead of me. What's it like being 70? Okay, the People's Army Jamboree. The first time I heard about the American Legion's plans for a convention in Portland the summer of 1970 was the previous December following a speech I made at the third of the moratoriums held nationwide in the autumn of 1969. A reporter from the Oregon Journal, a Vietnam veteran, told me the Legion was coming and suggested something ought to be done to confront their unconditional support of the Vietnam War. The most logical opposition would be Vietnam veterans, he said. As it turned out, Vietnam Veterans Against the War spearheaded the protest, but were only a small part of the amalgamation of Pacific Northwest anti-war organizations, a hodgepodge sardonically named for the occasion, the People's Army Jamboree. The idea of doing something about the presence of the American Legion in Portland was thought about through the winter and spring of 1970. More immediate matters took precedence, but after the strike in May at Portland State University, organizing to protest the Legion convention was front burner priority. It was unfortunate we had so long to wait, almost 3 months. By then, the devil of factionalism had subdivided us all almost to the point of dissolution. People who had been recognized as leaders of the local anti-war movement resisted relinquishing stature and power to newcomers who had evolved into the practical leadership during the strike in May. A new group of leaders emerged from the ranks of barricades persons who formed a community of spirit while isolating the campus from the outside world for 6 days, living together behind accumulations of furniture and rubbish. The barricade community dominated the strike, and its independent-minded citizenry rebelled against the organizational leadership that remained inside PSU's buildings and issued masses of mimeographed proclamations that were usually ignored. The same shift of power occurred during organizing of the People's Army Jamboree. The new group which emerged during the strike was voted to lead the PAJ in a tumultuous meeting of most of the esoteric groups who were to participate, representing most of the variations of Oregon's small counterculture, with the distinct exception of black activist groups. I was elected titular leader of the PAJ because I represented the VVAW, which was publicly promoted confronting the Legion. Vietnam veterans were obvious figureheads for our raggedy and clash with the Pentagon's war policies, as manifested by elder veterans, whose organization rubber-stamped virtually every military ambition and pretension. Ultimately, however, significant power remained with the old leaders, who opened negotiations with Portland city officials for a site in which to encamp whoever came into town to protest. At this point, the two factions started tearing at each other. One attempted to retain control by dealing with the city and encouraging the fear that Portland would be invaded by hordes of hippies. The other split rail sent out warnings to stay out of Portland because it might be an ambush to cripple the anti-war movement. This faction, the newcomers, which included me, also supported the governor's rock festival, Vortex, which was inspired to detour incoming demonstrators from Portland. Our support was from concern that police did not distinguish pot-smoking music lovers from hardcore political dissenters. With the cultural side of the counterculture removed, the streets of the city were open to the political side, which would be free from worry that its activities would harm the spaced-out innocents. I was not a very good organizer, but I had talent as a front man. I made speeches, was interviewed by local and network radio and TV, and also newspapers and wire services. I was allowed semi-equal time on the local broadcast media to counter a rather hysterical diatribe by Governor Tom McCall against the People's Army Jamboree, which I compared to a speech by Adolf Hitler in the early 30s, 1930s, to orchestrate public opinion for the upcoming Final Solution. Articles and newscasts escalated the tension, as did rumors that a hippie army planned to invade and take over Portland, and that residents had bought out the city's stock of Aero spray oven cleaner to be used in defense against forceful left-wing demonstrators. There were also rumors and substantial evidence that a trap was about to be sprung on us. The city was to be packed with police from all over Oregon and most of the state National Guard. The rest would surround the revelers at Vortex. A U.S. Army unit from Fort Lewis was to be stationed just across the Columbia River in Washington State. A few of us suspected a possible slaughter, a testing of how much public opinion would be strained by massacring a bunch of dope-smoking, long-haired, usually white, hippies in a far-off, not very important city in the upper left edge of the country. The previous year, police had attacked and killed several Black Panthers in a number of cities with hardly a murmur from the mainstream, known then as the silent majority. The Portland media portrayed the People's Army Jamboree as if it intended to maraud the city like a biker gang. Sympathetic National Guardsmen told us they were being trained in summer camp to attack hippies. Perhaps the sum of these parts didn't add up to our paranoia. But we who were paranoid would have been irresponsible to not attempt to prevent the possible disaster we were paranoid about. We few conspirators staged a clandestine operation to keep people out of Portland. We sent messages and made telephone calls to radical groups all over the country, warning them and explaining we didn't desire to attract fatal attention. We also allied ourselves with the efforts to organize Vortex, which would draw off the non-political hippies and suck up out-of-staters on the road for Portland. We told everybody else that this was our demonstration and we wished to do it by ourselves. In the meantime, we participated in negotiations with the city. We applied for parade permits and argued for the use of a city park for our counterculture encampment. We wanted beautiful Washington Park for our campground, which we visualized as a final romp of flower children among the park's famous roses. We got Delta Park instead, former site of the city of Vanport, which was washed away by a Columbia River flood on Memorial Day 1948. Frank Ivancy was City Parks Commissioner. We all considered him an evil, ambitious man, perhaps our single consensus, whose deceit had caused bloodshed during the spring student strike. Ivancy made headlines resisting our arguments for a park and condemned our plans of protest as traitorous and communist-inspired. He later used media accounts of his stout resistance to hippie disruption and a photo of me as villain in his campaign literature for mayor, which he eventually became after three attempts and was not reelected. So we bickered with the city for most of that summer while dreaming up a demonstration schedule as logistically complex as a military campaign. We were bequeathed $10,000 by a local potato chip heiress, and we rushed to waste the money as rapidly as we could. Some very sophisticated radio equipment was purchased, ostensibly to monitor police and National Guard movements during our days of rage. $1,000 was given to a local hippie lawyer as a retainer for a possibly heavy caseload in the near future. Another grand was used to purchase an offset printing press from a state auction, which printed small poetry books for years afterward. An uncounted and unattributed amount of the $10,000 disappeared into throats, noses, lungs, and bellies, wine, food, and drugs. Probably the worst that can be done with a fringe group is give it money. Fights break out immediately as to where the money will go and to whom. Entire movements have been torn up, arguing about money donated by sympathetic sponsors. That $10,000 almost disintegrated the People's Army Jamboree, and by the time we were able to regroup, half the money had been spent with little accounting of where it disappeared. We worked for most of the rest of the money we received, hats in hand, in my case, tongue out of cheek. A TV appearance or a guest shot on talk radio was good for several dollars in donations, as were speeches at open or closed gatherings of diverse radical and liberal groups engaged in various agendas. I was even a guest speaker at a luncheon of the inner sanctum of Portland political economic muscle, the City Club, though I don't believe I received any donations for the PAJ. A ticket for me to get out of town might have been a more popular fundraiser. By the time the American Legionnaires marched into Portland, everything seemed anticlimax. Tensions and fears had been so relentlessly exploited in the weeks and days before their arrival that the event itself was played through at half speed with a large sense of déjà vu. We conducted our descent peaceably to the contempt of the national press which had gathered in Portland and considered our lack of bloodshed the mark of lightweights. A columnist for the Washington Post, Nicholas von Hoffman, wrote, "The People's Army Jamboree is a lot like the Loch Ness Monster. Everybody's talking about it, but nobody has ever seen it." I presented an idea at the final hysteria pitch meeting of the PAJ crowd before Legion Week, which I thought was a radical departure from standard radical practice. To wit, a young girl walks through the city's deserted streets. She's about 8 years old. Her hair is long. She wears a dress. She carries a flower in one hand and sign in her other hand. "In the War" is printed in bright paint on the sign, which is a piece of wood nailed to a stake. She walks down the middle of several streets. On each side of every street, against buildings or grouped in open spaces, are armed policemen and state national guardsmen. They watch the girl menacingly. She sings only one song, "We Shall Overcome." The girl would have to be 8 or 9, not much older, or she risked rape. It would be a feast for television, I argued. Just a lone little girl, virginal, anyone's daughter or little sister, marching past the assembled might of the government. Look at the contrasts. Focus on the little girl in the empty streets. Close-ups of snarling cops wrapping their palms with nightsticks. National guardsmen with bayoneted rifles waiting. Various forms of paralyzing gases in handheld canisters. Newscasters, self-important voices edged with contempt at the uniformed brutes clustered in sinister ambush to molest the little girl. Perhaps split-screen the girl with marching American Legionnaires. No chance. The crowd wanted to march en masse. Do the usual hippie demonstration shtick. After most of a summer spent in tense anticipation and growing public hysteria for our spectacular, no one wished to stay out of whatever action was ahead. Everybody was impatient for the performance to begin. Yet for all that tense impatience, we were obsolete at the very moment of our presence. The real war was for racial and sexual equality as well as for economic justice. Our protest of an unpopular war was a brief recess from more enduring struggles. Everywhere the People's Army Jamboree appeared that week, the Legion was in town. It was ringed with concerned citizens who offered themselves as a buffer between us and the armed forces of law and order. They were a well-publicized group that called itself People for Portland and included nuns and ministers, as well as average everyday folk who were worried about violence between police and hippies. Among them, a gubernatorial candidate defeated in the state Republican primary in 1994 and was indicted for embezzlement, living now in Florida. Encounters with police were mild, which probably disappointed a few on both sides of the Police for Portland rings. My own tactics to keep the trigger on safe were to roam among demonstrators and quell outbreaks as they occurred, which usually meant pointing out troublemakers as police provocateurs, some of whom probably were. I didn't care. My intent was to isolate belligerent loudmouths before they caused the police to attack. We had a few undercover agents and informers within our ranks. One was a young rookie policeman who had been a Marine in Vietnam and intentionally bonded with me from that mutual experience. He fooled me, and I defended him against accusations that he was a spy. Yet he was a factor that none of us were arrested. Instead of provoking us to violence, which were probably his original orders, he defended us, reporting to his chief that we did not intend to commit any form of violence or illegal acts, and were prepared to prevent violence and crime within our ranks. Another reason we might not have been put in jail was more obscure and involved a chance meeting with Oregon Governor McCall. My friend Sailor John McGarrity, whose political grasp was brilliant, and I were walking downtown one afternoon a few weeks before Legion Week. We discovered McCall at the center of a small crowd cutting a ribbon to something flanked by stacks of watermelons. Sailor and I instantly agreed I should talk with the governor, which I did as he walked a few blocks to his limousine. McCall was a tall man with a lanky stride. I almost ran, keeping a pace with him while rapidly filling him in on our intentions, and warned him when we reached the car, his bodyguards politely behind us, that our informal chat could cause him to be subpoenaed if any of us were arrested. We marched three times through Portland streets. I made speeches before each march, but as a male was dissuaded from the second march, which was organized and conducted by feminists. I lost all copies of my first two speeches, which, if the third is an example, is not a great loss. My rhetoric was full sail as I whipped up the crowd for a final effort. "We walked into an armed camp, unarmed against three times our number," I said of the first two marches. "We walked into the barrels of rifles aimed at every one of us. We brushed against the teeth of the lion and came back out again. We showed them our courage against their hostile, brutal fear, and we refused to play their game. We refused to give them any reason for their club-swinging orgasms." I felt like I imagined Billy Sunday felt exhorting his flocks to wrestle sin when I said, "We are marching once more into the hostile storm which frantically perpetuates racism and sexism and can only answer our bitter, angry demands with guns and clubs." Fewer of us protested the presence of the American Legion that attended Vortex. The national media were disappointed we did not provide a bloody spectacle, as were several members of law enforcement. Proof that the confrontation was overblown from the beginning was apparent when President Nixon, who had planned to make a war speech to the Legion, sent in his place Vice President Spiro Agnew. A Greek-American who referred to everybody else as dagos, fat jabs, etc. Some say Nixon was frightened of being attacked, possibly assassinated. I think he realized the political insignificance of appearing in a substantially diminished public melodrama. The pre-convention display of hysteria had a sobering effect, and in the end, no one wanted to be responsible for the violence almost everyone feared or claimed to fear. Portland's residents did not wish a reputation for bloody civil war. That determined pressure to avoid violence was powerful enough to prevent it. And that was something I wrote, the People's Army Jamboree, and I think I should probably give a disclaimer that that's my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the entire cosmos. And I'd sort of like to follow this up, if I didn't drop something on the floor, with something along the same, Summers of Love and War. And a quote by, and this is something I wrote also, so the disclaimer is in place, and starts with a quote from Abby Hoffman: "You cannot have change without the young. The young have the creativity, they have the energy, they have the impatience. You need the youth to dissent." All sorts of people in prime middle age are reminiscing about the summer of 1967, which they call the Summer of Love, a drug-induced hallucination in which several thousand, mostly, pampered middle and upper-class white flower children briefly abandoned social strictures and sang and danced and fornicated like most of us imagine our wild and unfettered ancestors to have done in the primeval veldt before civilization and Christianity dampened our freewheeling pagan spirits. Mecca, that legendary summer of 1967, was San Francisco, Baghdad by the Bay, historic incubator and refuge for many radical and eccentric mythologies. For an ephemeral moment in a nation torn apart by an unpopular war and racial strife, a quick silver of fun and peace rippled through the stoned young masses who had swarmed into the city from all over the country with heads swaddled in blossoms. A song that summer urged westward-bound emigres, "If you go to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair." An ad hoc socialist republic boomed and bust as rapidly as an old gold rush town. Everything seemed free for the asking: food, lodge, medical care, sex, and wine, even the psychedelic drugs that fueled the dreamlike vision of a world of harmony, peace, and love. It all went badly quickly, of course. Before the summer was over, evil spirits had merged with the blithe, frolicking throngs of nirvana seekers, stealing, assaulting, and raping, selling toxic drugs, and generally creating an infection of bad vibrations. The rhapsodies of nostalgia about that long ago and far away summer seemed to ease over the ruthless struggles of that period. That same summer of 1967, American cities burned with racial hatred and insurrection, also despair. More than 200 other young Americans were dying in Vietnam every week, and God Buddha alone knows how many thousands of Vietnamese were killed between each Sunday and Saturday. The dream world itself soon darkened into nightmare. Two summers later, the counterculture that grew from the summer of love produced its most famous citizen, Charles Manson. The 1960s are set apart from other decades. They are different not so much for their intensity, the World War II years were far more intense, or because they were flamboyant and colorful, the jazz age of the 1920s had more splash, or for that matter because they were fueled by division and insurrection. The 1770s and 1860s make better claims. The significance of the 1960s is the example provided by the nation's indulgence in its youth, or perhaps more aptly, with a single immensely large generation of young people who responded by paradoxically souring on the nation at a time of unparalleled prosperity. The 1960s were a tumultuous period. The civil rights movement of primarily Southern blacks gave rise to a white civil rights movement of primarily disaffected youth who protested an unpopular and ill-conceived war that forced young males to fight and possibly be crippled or die. For the most part, the children of the working classes went quietly into induction in the war, and most of the nearly 60,000 dead and several hundred thousand wounded came from their homes. Primary opposition to the Vietnam War came from the nation's middle-class youth. As usual, upper-class whites were protected and could avoid service in the war, although many went into service, typically as officers, or were engaged in anti-war protest. Rampant ideologies and social solutions were conceived and died in the turbulent years of that decade. Revolution was a serious and futile flirtation, a malevolent and adolescent reaction against a paternal system that refused reform or criticism. Young Americans turned to animistic socialism. A new left replaced the old left and developed a political philosophy that loosely resembled Gypsy Law. They thought they could bind state socialism and social control with a tribal sense of individual freedom. The police and military showed the young resistors to authority that social change takes hard work and great pain, which few were inclined to exert. Reality, which means that all dreams take time for fruition and are modified by reality, disillusioned the young once more. The now generation found some other nows to be now about. A frustrated few tried to push against history, but were mostly killed or hunted into jail. Accidental explosion of homemade bombs literally wasted some of the best and brightest. If the 1967 summer of love and flower power was a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale for the young baby boomers, 1968 was surely a tale by the Brothers Grimm. It was a torrid year of assassinations, vainglorious battles in the overseas war, and increasingly violent anti-war demonstrations generally set off by police and National Guards armed with clubs, guns, and gas. The presidential campaign failed to change anything. The new Republican administration that was elected despised the young protesters and attacked them more viciously than ever, 2 years later culminating in the shooting deaths of four white students at Kent State in Ohio and at least two blacks, both women, at Jackson State University in Mississippi. The government also staged a number of show trials of anti-war activists in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but juries acquitted them all. In 1969, anti-war radicals responded to police murders of Black Panthers and arrests of activists by forming a violent vanguard that proclaimed the beginning of revolution, the Weathermen, later Weather People, whose rhetoric was always considerably more revolutionary than their acts, and whose homemade bombs blew up in their faces. But 1968 was also a year when an international youth movement might have linked. Not since 1848 had Europe been so united behind barricades. France, West Germany, Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring, and in Mexico at the 1968 Olympic Games, and Chicago, USA, on our side of the world. Revolutionary politics are saturated with hoped-for might-have-beens. No connection was made other than sympathetic, though often inflamed, oratory. In 1968, the war in Vietnam reached its most dramatic and painful peak, the Winter Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese armies and Viet Cong guerrillas, which included the long and bloody siege at Khe Sanh, reminiscent of Dien Bien Phu 14 years earlier. 1968 was the moral low water mark of the war. The devastation of the ancient imperial city of Hue and the slaughter of civilians by American soldiers at My Lai. President Lyndon Johnson surrendered his presidency to the war in 1968, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. sacrificed his life organizing poor blacks and whites against the economic system that impoverished them. Robert Kennedy, brother of the assassinated President John Kennedy, campaigned for the presidency on a promise to end the war and provide justice to the poor, and was murdered moments after victory in the California primary in June. In August 1968, a peak was also reached in the anti-war movement at the violent spectacle of the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago. The whole world was watching. Although culturists claim the 1960s got into swing around 1968, the theme of the decade was set at its start with the Black Civil Rights Movement. Not only did the violent and passionate search for racial justice inspire the later anti-war revolutionary New Left, earliest leaders of the movement were tempered by their own personal involvement in civil rights in the American South, registering blacks to vote, marching with blacks, and sharing the violent reaction. The other major influence was the Vietnam War, which provided the ignition point of youthful, mostly white rebellion, and added hardened veterans of the war to the largely college-oriented movement opposing it. The veterans, like the civil rights activists, were experienced with violence and capably reacted to attacks by police and state militias attempting to quell the revolt against national policy. The veterans who crossed political lines to oppose the war that seasoned and repelled them became immersed in leftist ideology, although many did not approve of it. Yet the political right had failed them, had inducted them into an unholy war, cloaked in righteous deceit, made them prisoners of conscience, whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came to the anti-war movement angry and embittered. Most of the veterans had a limited focus that ultimately was fatal to their campaign, far short of its goal to end the war. Similar to the majority of New Left organizations, Vietnam Veterans Against the War was at first stimulated by argument, but eventually debate and disagreement degenerated into quarreling animosities that broke the group apart. All that survived were two mutually hostile splinter groups that orbited a far and exotic fringe. The U.S. government's most powerful counterstroke was to virtually end the military draft, which almost immediately defused the rebellion. Draft-age males assured of avoiding combat service lost interest in the immorality of the war and also stopped thinking and talking about ideas and issues that grew from the war. Only diehards and incurable idealists persisted against the new wave of apathy, driven by hopeful or grim visions. The new left dissipated into a pabulum of new age kitsch. And that was Summers of Love and War. And I wrote that, so the disclaimer that I gave earlier should hold. And this has been Michael McCusker.